last time we started the English Reformation, and I mentioned that this is like the world's greatest soap opera, that this thing is wild beyond belief. And believe it or not, this is the story of how a king's divorce created a Protestant national church. So we're going to go through this. It's convoluted. It's tricky. So I'm going to try to... Are we working, Mar? Well, he tries to get that to work. I was thinking as Jeremy was talking about the gospel, I'm not a Academy Awards guy. I don't watch the show or any of that stuff, but I've been fascinated by the song that won this year. It's entitled, What Was I Made For? It's haunting. And it's a young woman, 22, who wrote this, and she's writing it as Barbie, you know, what was I made for? But it's also about her. I don't know how to feel, but I want to try. What was I made for? I thought I was real, but I was bought. I was a toy. So there are people asking these questions. Those are great gospel questions. It's not, as my mother would say, all that banging and clanging. It's just a piano with some strings occasionally, and it's haunting. Anyway, so I think I'll go ahead and start. We'll review. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay. That's better, in my case. So we talked about the distinctives of this. We talked about other distinctives, territorial, drama, length. These three contexts, the Lollards, these are the followers of Wycliffe. Humanism, not secular humanism. Humanism in the sense of getting back to the arts and the classics, trying to understand Christianity from the original documents. The role of the merchant class, because England had treaties with Germany and there's trade and they're bringing Lutheran ideas into England via the trade routes. And we talked about the Tudor dynasty, and I noted that this was the end of four-door carriages in England. They all had to be two doors because of the Tudors taking over. And... Henry VII, after a long civil war, becomes king. He has two sons. Arthur is supposed to be the guy, but Arthur dies. So Henry, the next son, takes over. And Arthur is married to Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon was Spanish and Roman Catholic. And the idea was, we'll form an allegiance, and this will provide a buffer against their traditional enemy, who was France. And we talked about Catherine and the idea here that Henry had said to his boy, Henry, whatever you do, you have to have a male heir. And Catherine's life is tragic. Many miscarriages, stillborn. And at the end of it all, she only has one living child, and that is a daughter. Consequently, in 1525, Henry begins to try to divorce Catherine. And there's a new young woman who's come in from the French court. Her name is Anne Boleyn. And I had mentioned that Henry was already, had taken her older sister as a mistress. And then, so what's going on in the court? Well, here's what's going on underneath. At Cambridge University, there are these scholars and students that are reading Lutheran stuff. And so it gets called Little Germany at the White House Inn, a pub. In response to this, Henry writes the Assertion of the Seven Sacraments, which is the assertion of the Roman Catholic conception of sacraments. And thus he receives Defender of the Faith title. And I think John said that's still on the English passport, or should I say the passport of the United Kingdom. So, now, we're going to go through this, and there's going to be lots of people. So I'm going to give you kind of a playlist. So if you want to think about this as a play, This is an Italian opera, okay? So these are the main players. And we can go back. So Protestant clergy, Thomas Bilney. He's sometimes called the last Lollard. That's the Wycliffe guys, the first Lutheran. He connects the two movements. He's a Cambridge man. He's initially a conscientious Catholic, but comes to teach that God's grace is given through faith. And he comes to that understanding by reading a new version of the Greek New Testament that the Roman Catholic scholar Erasmus has put together. In 1527, he's called before the Roman Catholic Cardinal, Cardinal Wolsey, and he recants his faith. However, he also begins to correspond with Tyndale. 1531, he recants his recantation. Now, here's the weirdness that represents this early phase. This is bizarre. How does this work together? He believes in justification by faith, but he also believes in purgatory, and he also believes in the Mass, transubstantiation. And you're like, how does that work? Well, that shows you the mess that's going on. There's just all kinds of things floating around, and people are trying to sort this out. He hated clerical abuse, and this is all happening during the time of Henry's divorce, and his doctrinal beliefs are typical of the mess in England at this time. Robert Barnes, another Cambridgeman, he's a diplomat. He's influenced by Bilney, but less cautious. He attacks the church in a sermon at Cambridge and is placed under house arrest. He escapes to Wittenberg and studies with Luther. If we ever go to Wittenberg, you can see the house. They have plaques up where these guys were, and you see Robert Barnes. He studies with Luther in Wittenberg. 1531, he appeals to Henry VIII. He says Lutheranism does not threaten the monarchy. Henry says, okay. So he returns to England. Shortly after returning, he attacks the Roman Catholic Bishop John Gardiner, which ends up getting him beheaded. As I noted, he is less cautious than Bilney. Hugh Latimer. He's the dominant preacher in the English-speaking world. In fact, the modern English sermon finds its origins in the preaching of Hugh Latimer. Nobody's heard of him, but he is setting the standard. He is influenced by the Lollards and Luther. Cambridge again. He's ordained as a priest. 1525, he starts to read and come in contact with these young Cambridge professors and students who have been influenced by Luther, and he converts. He especially credits Thomas Bilney for this. He becomes the Bishop of Worcester. Now, I know that's spelled Worcester, but it's their language. They can pronounce it however they want. Worcester is correct, is it not?
It's correct, but the spelling is incorrect.
Uh-oh.
There is no H or H. And so it's Worcester, but it's Worcester.
Well, I'm going to have to go back and check the book I got this from and write the letter to the editor.
Throw it away.
Yeah, I will. Because of his successes in popularizing the Reformation, Latimer is immediately marked for, that should be proscription is, anyway. I'm skipping ahead here, but at one point, England becomes Catholic again, and he is arrested, and he's taken to Oxford for trial, and he's burned on High Street in front of St. Mary's, if I remember right, which is the main cathedral there. He's burned with Nicholas Ridley and Bilney, I think. And he makes this marvelous speech. They're being carried away to be burned at the stake, and Ridley's frightened, as we all would be. And he says to Ridley, Bear up, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. And so he's aggressive. He's evangelistic. He is in your face. And Latimer. William Tyndale, probably the one name you know. I'm quite certain Mark and Carol are familiar with William Tyndale. He's an Oxford grad, but he taught at Cambridge. He translates the Bible. He does not complete the Bible before his death. He translated the Pentateuch, Jonah, and the entire New Testament. It's a mediocre translation, frankly, with significant Lutheran influence. There are some scholars that argue that he actually copied Luther. A lot of the introductions to the books are actually Luther's introductions. 1524, the New Testament is published in Cologne and in Worms, Germany. Can't get them published in England, so he gets them published in Germany. And how do they get in? They come in through that merchant class that we talked about. This is like, what was it, Brother Andrew smuggling in Bibles. He is a major conduit of Reformation theology to England. He is declared a heretic by both Henry and the Pope. Double whammy. And so he flees to the continent. And he's hanging out in Antwerp. In Antwerp, he is trapped by agents of the papacy. He's charged with heresy. And for translating the Bible, he is executed by strangling. And then his body was burned on a stake. So that's Tyndale. Nicholas Ridley. Do I need to go slower? I'm going through a lot of stuff. Okay, Nicholas Ridley's the most gifted. Again, Cambridge, ordained a priest. Becomes a Protestant. Becomes a chaplain to Thomas Cranmer, who we'll learn more about. Becomes the Bishop of London. Under Ridley, the see or the post in London was made into a showpiece of Reformed England. He denied the doctrine of transubstantiation. That's the idea that Christ is naturally present. We've talked about that. He supported the claim of Lady Jane Grey, and we'll talk about that more later. And he is burned with Latimer and Bilney in Oxford at 1555. Protestants. Thomas Cromwell, politicians. Protestant politicians. Thomas Cromwell. I'll just make this short. He starts out initially working with the Roman Catholic Cardinal Wolsey. He becomes very important to Wolsey, and then eventually to Henry VIII as part of this divorce mess. He helps, or tries to help, the king get a divorce. It doesn't work, and the guy that takes the fall for that is Cardinal Wolsey, who we'll talk about here momentarily. That leaves Cromwell to become Henry's kind of number one advisor guy, and he sets up a marriage between Henry VIII and a Lutheran princess named Anne of Cleves. That didn't work. And because it didn't work, Cromwell was accused of treason and all sorts of other stuff, and he ends up getting beheaded. So he's a Protestant politician, but probably not a committed Protestant. Back to the Catholics, Cardinal Wolsey. The main deal here is that Wolsey was the main papal representative when Henry starts all this divorce stuff. He has one job as far as Henry is concerned. Get me out of this marriage. And he fails. And Henry increasingly is frustrated. Numbers of Wolsey's enemies accuse him of treason. and he is called back to London, frankly, to be executed, but fortunately for him, he actually dies on the way back. Wolsey. Stephen Gardiner, here's another Roman Catholic. He's the Bishop of Winchester. Head of the Church of England, he's a Catholic who forms the backbone of the Counter-Reformation, which we'll talk about, seeking to overthrow Cromwell. He becomes an important advisor to Mary I and dies. Sir Thomas More, you probably heard of this, A Man for All Seasons, you may have seen the movie. He's an English lawyer, a social philosopher, a statesman. He serves Henry VIII as the Lord High Chancellor. He's opposed to the Protestant Reformation. And he's directing attacks against the theology of Luther, Zwingli, and Tyndale. What gets him in trouble is this. Henry is going to eventually break with the Catholic Church. More says no. The only way Henry can get a divorce, since the Pope won't grant him one, is to break with the Church. And so he does. And they pass something called the Act of Supremacy. The Act of Supremacy says this: the monarch is the supreme head of the Church of England. That is still the case. On paper, Charles III, he's the third, right? Yeah, because he's not a Stuart. Charles III is technically the head of the Church of England. Because of that, Henry can't tolerate this, and he ends up having More beheaded. John Fisher. He is also involved in this. He's questioning this marriage. He refuses to sign the Act of Succession like More, and he is executed. And to make his point, his body is left to lie all day on the scaffold, and his head is hung on London Bridge. Okay. So these are your main players. Now let's get back to the story. Well, as we need to. Okay, so it's now 1529. Remember, Henry is trying to get a divorce. He needs a new wife, he thinks, because he needs a boy. The Pope is blocking the divorce. He is getting pressure from Charles V. Now, again, I warned you, this was going to be complicated. Charles V has an aunt. His aunt's name is Catherine of Aragon, the person that Henry is trying to divorce. So the emperor, Charles V, says to the Pope, "Don't you do this to my aunt." Pope says, "Well, I'm either going to side with Henry VIII or the emperor. I'm taking the emperor." And so this thing gets blocked. A new guy emerges, Thomas Cranmer. He says, "Well, let's go to Europe. We'll see if any of the great scholars in Europe have any ideas to get you out of this." And he's become Lutheran. He actually secretly gets married when he's over on the continent. But this is all hush-hush. 1529, Henry says, "I'm going to change the parliament." He does. 1530, as we mentioned, here comes Cardinal Wolsey. He hasn't got the annulment done, so he's coming back to be killed, but he dies along the way. 1532, now he's going to start pulling out the big guns. The Act in Restraint of Annates is passed. Now, what does that mean? It means this: only 5% of the money that is normally sent to Rome is going to be sent to Rome. Okay, so the church collects taxes. Where do those taxes go? Rome. We're keeping 95% of those for ourselves. Okay. 1532. Thomas Cranmer, who was secretly a Protestant, is named Archbishop of Canterbury. So the king's the head, and then the highest church office is Archbishop of Canterbury. Okay? So he's the head under the king. The act of restraint of appeals. This means people can't appeal to the Pope to overthrow what Henry says about the church. You can see where this is going. I mean, this is, yeah. 1533. Thomas Cranmer annuls the marriage. The king has already married pregnant Anne Boleyn the previous January. But they wait till this annulment, and she's publicly crowned in June. What does the Pope do? Well, he does what popes do. He excommunicates Henry. 1534, a new act of succession. Here's what this means. It means the children or the daughter of the first marriage, Catherine, is no longer a rightful successor to the throne. Basically declares them illiterate. The only legitimate successors will be any children I have with Anne Boleyn. And then to seal the deal, act of supremacy. The monarch is the supreme head of the Church of England. This is a totally new model. We've never seen anything like this. What kind of church will this be? That's the question. Well, 1535. The Protestants are happy because it seems to be going in a Protestant direction. Miles Coverdale completed Tyndale's Bible, and so the complete English Bible appears. Thomas Cromwell, who's a Protestant politically, is named to an important post. Two important Catholics are put to death. Thomas More, John Fisher. 1536, all right, we're going to have a doctrinal statement. 10 articles. They're Lutheran-esque, or we might say Lutheran-lite. Wow, everything looks great. Well, what about the second wife? She's in trouble. She's only had one surviving child, a daughter. She had a boy. It was stillborn, or he was stillborn. Further, here we go again. There's another young woman around. Her name is Jane Seymour, not to be confused with Jane Seymour, Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, different Jane Seymour. And so Cromwell, he's a politician now, conspires against Anne and turns Henry against Anne. Consequently, she is tried for treason and beheaded. I told you this was going to be weird. Okay. So, 1536, you know, behead one and May 30, I'll marry another one, Jane Seymour. Now, the Protestants suffer a big loss because Tyndale, who has been stuck in Antwerp, as I mentioned, was caught and he's executed. This is kind of interesting and cool, and it has modern relevance. Between 1536 and 1539, Henry dissolves the monasteries. Remember, he wakes up one day and says, hey, wait a minute, if I'm the head of the church, I own all this stuff. I got a great idea. I'm going to loot what I want. Then I'm going to dissolve them. And then, in order to secure support, I'm going to give them to important families. So many of these large estates in England were originally monasteries. I give you, ladies and gentlemen, a very widely watched show from public television entitled Downton What? Abbey. Ever think about that? It was originally an abbey, a monastery. And apparently Lord whatever his name was given that by Henry back in the day. And that's a lot of these things go this way. So, Jane Seymour has a boy. Everybody's happy. However, she dies 12 days later. Very tough labor. Henry is absolutely distraught. 1538, there's an English Bible placed in all the churches. So I just want you to think about this. Imagine if you're just a normal person, and for the first time in your entire life, you go to church, and there's a Bible there. Wow, it's stunning. However, Henry is really a Roman Catholic if you scratch under the surface. So he says, we're not going that way. He takes out the 10 articles and puts the 6 articles in. So here are the 6 articles. Sacrament of the altar. This is transubstantiation. Communion in both kinds is not necessary. That means we're not going to give both the cup and the bread. We're just giving the bread. Priests may not marry. Vows of chastity made to God ought to be observed by the law of God. Private masses will be continued admitted in the King's English Church and congregation. And then lastly, confession to a priest will be reestablished. Very Roman Catholic. Protestants are absolutely flipped out. So, here we are, it's 1540. He has a boy, his name's Edward. His beloved wife has died. Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell, the Protestant politician, says, look, you need another wife, number one, number two. We need an ally, a Protestant ally. So there's this Lutheran priest in Germany who has a daughter, Anne of Cleves. I've seen the painting. Cromwell sets up this marriage. Anne of Cleves gets off the boat. Now, there's discrepancy on this. Some people say there is a vast distinction between the painting and the person, and that Henry supposedly called her a Flanders mare. But there's other scholarship that says that's just apocryphal. Whatever, he does not like her. And this marriage lasts from January to July. It's annulled. 1540, I'm going to marry again. A young woman. She's Roman Catholic, but not a pious Roman Catholic. She was probably a teenager. He's about 30 years older than her. She is a vivacious young woman. That's code word for you know what. And so she is engaging in numerous affairs, which Henry gets wind of. And so she is beheaded. And Thomas Cromwell is beheaded the same day, because he set up this mess with Anne of Cleves. I'm sorry, he's married. Cromwell is executed the same day that Henry marries Catherine of Howard, and then, you see, February, she's beheaded for adultery. Last marriage, Catherine Parr. He is an old man. She is an older woman. This is for companionship. He's suffering from a septic leg. He had a jousting injury that never healed. He's suffering from diabetes, Cushing's disease, mild stroke, syphilis, and the jousting wound. So you ought to feel better about your health now. He dies. His boy takes over, Edward VI. So when he dies, he's got 3 kids. Mary, from the first wife. Elizabeth. Edward. Edward, from the third wife. When he dies, Edward, son of Jane Seymour, becomes Protestant. He's only 10 years old. And he pushes the church in a Protestant direction. And now it's going to become overtly Protestant. So it has become sort of non-papal Catholic. I surrender. Hello, hello, hello. No. No, no, no. Yes, yes, yes. No, no, no. Yes, yes. This is like the English Reformation. On again, off again. On again, off again. Okay. Is it working now? It's working now, Mar. Famous last words. Yep. Okay, so he takes over, he's 10 years old, and he's going to make this church Protestant. First Book of Common Prayer, Thomas Cranmer. The prayer book, it's basically the liturgy and the worship practices of the church. Up till then, it had been done in Latin and reflected Roman Catholic belief. But references to the Pope were removed in the old service. The book did not change much of the doctrine, but it mandated it be done in English. So the previous service was a Catholic service done in England or in English. Second Book of Common Prayer. This is a radical change, especially the language used to describe communion. This is a thoroughly Protestant service. There's no transubstantiation stuff. 42 articles, the doctrinal statement. It replaces the six. The primacy of Scripture, justification by faith alone, no purgatory, no transubstantiation. Unfortunately, he is not a well young man. And so at the age of 16, he dies. Now what do we do? There's two kids left. So the Protestants panic. And they find a 16-year-old young woman named Lady Jane Grey. She is the great-granddaughter of Henry VII, okay, and a first cousin once removed from Edward VI. This doesn't work. And she is beheaded 9 days after she is named queen. Now what? We got two kids left. Well, the oldest one is Mary. Mary Tudor, because the Protestants won, she got the nickname Bloody Mary. If the Catholics had won, she would be Happy Mary. But, and she says, nuts to all this Protestant stuff, we're Catholic again. Okay, we're Catholic again. So she puts the church under the Pope again. She's named Queen. She returns the Church of England to Rome. She also persecutes Protestants. Fox's Book of Martyrs, a lot of that comes from this time period. During her 25-year reign, she had over 280 religious dissenters burned at the stake. The most notable were Cranmer, Ridley, and Latimer. So those three we talked about, they were burned under her. A Roman Catholic, Gardiner, becomes Lord High Chancellor. And she marries Philip I of Spain. This is going to cement this Catholic and Spanish union, just like her mom. However, she does not bear any children. The marriage to Philip is very unpopular, and she eventually is weakened by uterine cancer and dies as a result of influenza. Now what do we got left? Here's what we got left. Edward's dead. Mary's dead. Elizabeth's coming. Yes. Because she's Catholic. Okay, well, look. What law had been passed? a law of succession because that her mother's marriage had never been dissolved by the Pope. So if she accepts Protestantism, she is declaring herself illegitimate because the Protestants did not accept the marriage. They accepted the annulment. Well, no. I'll put it this way. As I sort of mentioned at the beginning of this, this is a weird mixture of politics and religion. Some of these people are sincere Christians. Some of them are political. Do I think Mary was a sincere Roman Catholic? Absolutely. But she also had political reasons to be Roman Catholic. Because as long as she was Roman Catholic, her birth was legitimate and she was a rightful heir because the Pope never dissolved that marriage. So what does Elizabeth do? She puts in place the Elizabethan settlement. Two parts to this. Act of supremacy. Once again, now Pope isn't head, monarch's head. It reestablishes the monarch. Second part was the act of uniformity. This reestablishes the Book of Common Prayer. This is also the beginning of Puritanism. Puritans were people who said the Elizabethan settlement is too much of a compromise, and therefore we are unhappy about that. 39 articles, Elizabeth dies, it's the end of the Tudor dynasty. So here are the Tudors. Henry VIII, he has six wives. Catherine of Aragon, divorced. Anne Boleyn, beheaded. Jane Seymour, dies. Anne of Cleves, divorced. Catherine Howard, beheaded. Catherine Parr, survives. Catherine of Aragon, Catholic. Anne Boleyn, Protestant. Jane Seymour, Protestant. Anne of Cleves, Protestant. Catherine Howard, Catholic. Catherine Parr, Protestant. Okay. Edward VI, his mother's Jane Seymour. He's a Protestant. Mary I, she's a Catholic. A devoted Catholic. Elizabeth I is a moderate Protestant. I think I have here, yes, the Elizabethan settlement. So we'll explain this. It sought to provide a compromise between Protestants and Catholics by making a Church of England that had elements of both. The Church of England was Protestant at its core, but took the hierarchy from the Catholics by keeping archbishops and bishops. The Elizabethan settlement did not heal the divide between Protestants and Catholics. However, those who refused to comply were persecuted. The church that Elizabeth created is unique. There is none other like it in Europe. Additionally, today's Anglican church structure is essentially the same as the one that was put in place in 1563. So, what is the Church of England? Protestant at its core, structurally very Roman Catholic. Historically, the Church of England has been described as having three parts. The High Church, sometimes called the Church of Smells and Bells. That's the one that you see when one of the monarchs get married or something like that. Okay. Then you have what's called the Low Church. That's generally evangelical. That would be people like John Stott, J.I. Packer, folks like that. Then you have what's called the Broad Church. And the Broad Church is kind of anybody that's born in England. Although that's less of a deal today, isn't it, John? It's non-existent.
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, because, at least partly because of the large influx of Islamic folks. But traditionally, the Broad Church was anybody who was born in England is de facto a member of the Church of England. for years, in fact, non-conforming churches, that is, non-Anglican churches, weren't even called churches. So Spurgeon's church is called Metropolitan Tabernacle. And one of the ways you used to be able to tell is, I'm going to church on Sunday meant I'm Anglican. I'm going to chapel on Sunday meant I'm Baptist or Methodist or pick it, okay? Because technically there's only one church, wink, 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 wink. These things are all sort of falling apart, but historically that's been the way the thing has worked. Ah. Okay, I tried, that's the best I could do to get a flag, Great Britain. I'm sorry, John. At least they don't have stars on it. That would have been, you know, very American. So, what happens then? Well, there is a relative up in Scotland. Jimmy Stewart is up in Scotland. He's finished filming It's a Wonderful Life, and so they said, let's make him king. Not really. He is James the Fourth of Scotland, who takes the title James the First of England. So the Stuart dynasty is established. And here is where Puritans start to really make a lot of noise under the Stuarts. James the First is famous for something that most of us that are older grew up with. The King James Version of the Bible, 1611, the Authorized Version, was done under the rule of King James. He authorized the New Translation, and it was finished in 1611, just 85 years after the first translation, that is Tyndale-Coverdale Bible. Now, I'm going to stop here. What this does is it unites Scotland and England, and this is forming Great Britain, which is not widely used today. I think the acceptable term today is United Kingdom, correct?
For the unwashed, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you thought American politics was bizarre. Anyway, so let me stop here. I've gone through a lot of stuff. There's a couple things I want you to think about. I want you to imagine what it was like for lay people. This is terrifying. Remember, way, 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 way back when I started, medieval people are more concerned about the life to come than this life. They know they are going to die. And the question they are trying to answer is, what happens to me when I die? Where do I go and how can I know? Well, I thought we were Catholic. Oops. We're sort of Catholic. But no, maybe we're Protestant. There's a Bible here in the Ten Articles. Oh, I guess we're kind of Roman Catholic-ish. The Six Articles. And then, now we're really, really, really Protestant. Okay, there's Bibles and we're going to clean all this Roman stuff out of the church. We've got to get all the popishness, they call it, get that stuff out of here for 6 years. Then we're Roman Catholic again. And think about people that were monastic. If you're a monk or a nun, and then Edward comes along and says, your vows are no longer valid, you're going to get married. And because singleness doesn't work very well in that world. So you're married for 6 years, and then Mary comes along and says, no, your vows are all, you have to go back for 5 years. And then, no, you're married again. And you hopefully the person you married hasn't married somebody else in the meantime. So the amount of chaos this is creating among common people, remember, they don't read much. They're dependent on these folks to guide them in their spiritual life. They need answers to these questions. And it's a nightmare. It creates chaos. We'll pick it up more next week, but this is why the next step after all of this is going to be a civil war. And you can understand why. People are confused and angry, and they don't know what's going on, and they're getting mixed messages all over the place. And it's deeply, deeply troubling to common folks. We live in a world where we're used to making up our own mind, and we have access to material, and we can read and all that kind of stuff. That's not the way the world has been for most of its history. We're really unique. And the trauma, the tragedy for these folks in terms of what do I believe is absolutely, utterly stunning. And you know, it's one thing for us to sit here and kind of go through this and go, that's weird. But there is a human side to this and a spiritual side to this. That there are people here that are seeking to understand God and be right with the Lord, who are, you know, these are sheep without a shepherd. And it's tragic. So, we have time for some questions. Yes.
You'll be next.
Mark, and then we'll get you.
You've mentioned the Tyndale New Testament of 1526, printed on the continent, smuggled into England, and the archbishop said, let's burn all of these New Testaments. This is terrible, heretical. English New Testament? Who ever heard of such a thing? There are three copies left that survived of the 1526 edition. One of them is kept in a cabinet in the office of the archivist at St. Paul's Cathedral. Mm. And about 5 years ago when I was in London, I was invited to go to his office.
Cool.
He unlocked his cabinet, and there was a 1526 Tyndale New Testament.
Wow. Where are the other two, Mark? Do you know?
I think one is in the British Museum and one is on the continent.
Huh. Cool.
Okay, so you may have said this, but why did the influence of Luther not influence these people more? Is it because of the lack of ability to communicate that you were talking about?
You mean the common people? Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the clergy? Are you talking about the monarchy? Are you talking about common people? Because they can't read. The literacy is very low. So they are utterly dependent on what they're being told. So that's what I'm saying. That the import... They didn't. Because schools assume that people have disposable income and time to, they don't need to live. Children were working. I mean, who's going to till the field? It's not like you can go to Jewel. If the potatoes don't grow, we're dead. And every mouth that is capable of doing something is going to do something. Back here, John.
Hey, I had a quick question. So I realize all this is going on in England at the time. So, I mean, there's a lot of history to cover here. But kind of in a just kind of brief sense, what was going on back in mainland Europe, especially back in Germany where Luther was, when all this is going on in England? What's kind of taking place back on the mainland?
Well, Luther has established the Lutheran movement. He is excommunicated in 1520. The Augsburg Confession is, I forget the year. So Lutheranism is established in certain parts of Germany. Calvin is early in his career, so there isn't a whole lot going on in French-speaking Switzerland. German-speaking Switzerland, Zwingli is there. Both of those movements tend to be oriented internally. And it's not because they didn't believe in missions. It's because when you're under threat. So there is numbers of vibrant Protestant movements going on in the continent. The connection between them and England is depends on who the king is, and it depends on trade. So again, what's different about this is the king or the queen is deciding what the church is going to be. We haven't seen that before. That's different than what we saw before in Bill. John is coming.
Sorry, it feels like an ignorant question, but I feel like we're suddenly using the term Protestant. Did these people think of themselves as Protestants, or when did that start?
The term Protestant is first used in 1529 at the Diet of Speyer, when I think it's 9 or 11 Lutheran princes protested an attempt by Charles V to force them to use Catholic liturgy, etc. And they said, no, we're going to do the Augsburg Confession. And so they were called protesters. Before that, they were called evangelicals. Honestly, I don't know what they were calling them in England. Bad names?
Yeah, I would point out that a lot of this is connected to land deals.
Yes.
So if you became a Protestant prince in Germany, you got to take the church's stuff. And if the church, because the Holy Roman Emperor was pretty weak. And so if you were forced to go back to Catholicism, you were going to have to give it back.
Back.
And they certainly didn't want to do that.
Yeah. I had a a pastor once who said the ark floated on dirty water. There are a lot of people that are becoming Protestant for reasons other than they really believe they're Protestants. There's mixed motives all over the place in this. And what's the message for us? God's working. He used Balaam's donkey. He can use insincere politicians. So we shouldn't assume these people, we shouldn't be cynical about them all, but we shouldn't just immediately assume that they were faithful either. It's a hard mix. And on that note, it's 10:32. I owe you 2 minutes, so I'm going to pray. Lord, I'm grateful that you are active in the affairs of men and women, that the king's heart is like a river in your hand. You turn it where you will. We don't understand these things. I don't understand. We certainly do not understand why you did this way, but you did. And forgive us for forgetting that you are the sovereign. And teach us, Lord, to trust you and to know that you do all things well, even in what looks like a complete mess. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'll see you in 2 weeks.